I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hi everyone, welcome to episode 162 of the Intercooler Podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel. Now, it's early summer in Europe, which must mean it's 24-hour race season. So that's what we're talking about this week. Before we get onto that, let me just remind you, as I do every week, please, to rate and review the podcast. It's really important. And while you're doing it, just hit the follow button or the subscribe button on whichever app you're using. That just takes seconds. And it means you won't miss an episode of the Intercooler Podcast. And it means that we find a bigger audience. So please do that. Thank you very much and enjoy the episode. With the Nürburgring 24 hours just gone and the 100th anniversary edition of Le Mans coming up in a couple of weeks, seems like a good idea, a good time to talk about 24-hour racing.
Yeah.
Right? And we're going to do how to win a 24-hour race.
Yes.
And how not to win a 24-hour race.
Yes.
We're going to talk about what it takes to win one of these epic events and just how wrong, despite all your best efforts, it can go.
Yeah. And we're going to basically use Le Mans as the sort of event to represent all 24-hour events.
Yeah. Now, we're going to start with how to win one of these things. And I'm not talking here from a place of experience. I've never won a 24-hour race.
I've been in a few.
Yes.
I've certainly never won one.
I've done a 24-hour kart race.
Oh, okay.
Years and years ago, my team were utterly shambolic. It was actually one of the more miserable things I've ever done. It just seemed to go on and on and on.
I tried to do one once, and I got so exhausted early on. I just gave up, and everybody else just took it on. And I'm not sure it was a 24-hour one, but I got so tired.
Yeah.
I don't think I could do more than about 40 minutes in it. And then I was just completely ruined.
It's a very particular type of fitness, karting.
Yeah.
So and if you're doing a 45 minutes.
And also, if you're a big bloke, like I am, 16 stone on a good day, you're not doing the power to weight ratio of your kart any good at all.
No.
That was my excuse for being so slow anyway.
Okay, so let's just rattle through some of the fundamentals, the basics that need to be in place if you're going to win a 24-hour race.
Finish it.
To finish first, you've got to finish.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, the only 24-hour races in which I've ever come anywhere at all, and I think the best I did was P4 in the Silverstone 24 hours in, I think, 2015 in a GT4 Aston Martin. We just trundled around. We were not fast at all.
Oh, really?
No. The only person we had on our team who was fast was Alice Powell, who is now a star of what was W Series. And there was myself and there was Aston's then CEO, Andy Palmer, myself and Marek Reichman, their current design director, and Alice. And so basically three middle-aged amateurs and someone who actually knew what she was doing. At that point, Alice wasn't in the car. We just kind of trundled around and didn't crash. And we came somewhere. She was very fast when she was in it, and that was great. And that's, certainly historically speaking, that's what you had to do. It's the reason that people like Stirling Moss hated doing Le Mans. because they didn't consider it to be a proper motorist, because they weren't flat out. They were just trying to get round. These days, they build the machines to survive basically anything.
Yeah.
So you can't just trundle around. You've got to go flat out from the start, because what you know is that if you don't, someone else will, and they'll win it.
Mm.
So you've just got to throw caution to the wind and just absolutely go. But I mean, but that's quite a recent thing.
Yeah.
Certainly through the vast history of a race like Le Mans. It was a race of attrition. I mean, sometimes you would get, you know, in 1970, the first win for Porsche, there were 55 cars entered, 51 cars started it, and 7 finished.
Only 7?
Only 7.
Blimey.
It was actually one of the things I was going to talk about. You know, and Richard Attwood, he deliberately chose, because he'd done so well the year before, in the night which broke with a lead of several laps with 21 hours to go, he got to choose what car he was in and who he'd drive it with. So he chose a 4.5-litre 917 when he could have had a 5-litre car, and he chose a 4-speed gearbox when he could have had a 5, and he chose Hans Herrmann, who was a capable sports car driver, but absolutely no superhero, because he just thought, we need a combination that's going to get us round. And all his teammates went for 5-litre cars and Formula 1 drivers and 5-speed gearboxes, and they broke and he didn't.
Mm.
That's what you have to do.
QED.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was 1970, and it is a different discipline now, isn't it? And I remember talking to Ollie Gavin about this back in 07, 08, the Corvette factory driver. It was the first time I'd been to Le Mans, and I naively said to him, so I understand that it's you're not going as hard as you can. And he said, ha, no, boy, we are. Now, of course, they are thinking about tyre life. They are thinking about fuel usage. They are thinking about not destroying the car.
Yeah.
If you do any of those things, your race is over. If you're in the pits too often because you're burning through tyres, you're burning through fuel,
yeah,
you're going to lose.
But what they're not doing anymore is watching their revs.
Yes.
What they're not doing is particularly being careful over curbs. All these things which would have just destroyed races for cars in the past. The cars are so robust. They are designed to, that's what you choose to do, to be driven flat out for 24 hours.
So they are going as fast as they can while, to some degree, thinking about tyre usage, thinking about fuel usage.
Yeah. But that's all strategy. The difference is that's about strategy. That's not about making sure your car finishes. That's just about making sure that you...
Yes.
complete the race in the quickest time possible, which, as we all know, is partly about going fast, and it's also partly about, you know, minimizing the number of pit stops you have to do, fuel stops you have to do, and so on and so forth. But in terms of the preservation of the cars are designed to go flat out.
Well, that's it. There you go. That's one of the key things that you need to win a 24-hour race, a car that will go flat out reliably. And actually, it's probably the reliability that's the most impressive thing, isn't it? It is thousands of miles that they do over a 24-hour race. At the N24 just gone, they did, it was a record distance, 162 laps, 15.7 mile lap, because it's the Nordschleife and the Grand Prix circuit. That's more than 2,500 miles.
Yeah.
Going very, very fast.
More than 2,500 miles on a circuit which doesn't, it's got one straight, but most of it is just...
All of that.
Exactly. Yeah.
It is amazing.
And it was one, and also, you know, hats off to the Fricadelli Ferrari.
Yeah.
Quite poignant, really, because Fricadelli was Sabine Schmidt's team, and Ferrari, first team in 20 years, non-German team to win that race in 20 years.
Is that right?
I think so. Yeah.
Blimey.
Yeah.
It's and all the first Ferrari win as well.
First Ferrari win. Just brilliant.
Yeah.
A 296 GTB.
Yes, GT3, yeah. So there you go. You need a fast and reliable car. Presumably, now this is relative, isn't it? Because the guys who are driving these factory cars are phenomenally quick, and... the car cannot be on such a knife edge or so tricky to drive that the drivers are making mistakes. However, I'm sure if I drove that car, I'd find it a nightmare.
Yeah, but I mean, again, these days, you know, there was an era where, you know, Le Mans used to be the preserve of the gentleman driver.
Mm.
And cars had to, I mean, one of the things that Porsche was so good at, which they just don't have to do anymore, is they used to, particularly when they're selling customer cars, customer 956s and 962s, is... there was this thing about the least reliable component of the car is the bit that sits in the seat and hangs onto the steering wheel, pressing the pedals. Yeah. And so you've got to make sure that he, because it almost always was a he, has as good a chance of not making a mistake as possible. Mm. That's why they had synchromesh gearboxes. Mm. That's why they started on a key. That's why they thought really hard about things like ventilation.
Mm.
None of these things, actually the synchromesh gearbox slowed the car down.
Mm.
But, yeah, nothing like as much as, you know, taking the edge off a dog box gear and losing third gear for the rest of the race. Mm. And that's what they had to do in the era of gentleman drivers. But these days, with paddle shifts and professionals, you don't need to think about that sort of stuff at all.
Mm. Clearly, you need a team that runs like clockwork, great strategy, slick pit stops, that's a given. But you also need three or four drivers, depending which race it is, who are prepared to work as a team, don't you?
Yeah.
You don't need any solo heroes out there.
And that is the amazing thing about people who do that. It's why so few Formula One drivers, really good Formula One, have turned out to be really good at Le Mans. Yeah. Because they might be really, really quick over a lap, but yeah, the mindset is so different. Because you get into a Formula One car, it's just you and against everybody else. And you know that when the race is over, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours later, they'll take the car to pieces and that. You get into a more car, all you must be thinking about is the person who's going to get in the car after you. You've got to bring it back. It's got to be in the right car. And it's a completely different mind. And if you talk to, you know, multiple Le Mans winners, guys like, I don't know, Tom Christensen, Derek Bell, they're just, more than enough, they're just such nice people. Mm. And I don't think that's a coincidence. Because, you know, if they're not sort of collegiate, inclusive and happy to work as a team, if they are these, you know, I think to be a superstar in Formula One, a Michael Schumacher, an Ayrton Senna, a Max Verstappen, a Lewis Hamilton, you have to be so single-minded. Mm. And it is you against everybody else. You know, basically, the difference is, in Formula One, your closest rival, your greatest rival is your teammate. Mm. Mm. Whereas in sports car racing, he's your ally.
He's your best friend, isn't
yeah.
he? Okay, let me put this to you. The Fernando Alonso of 2007.
Yes.
Did you ever see him being a Le Mans winner?
No.
But the Fernando Alonso of today, he seems a totally reformed character,
yes,
doesn't he?
Yes, and also I think there are always exceptions that prove rules, and I think that there yeah. are yes people who can just adapt.
Mm.
And he does. He is a completely different human being as well. If you think about the Fernando Alonso who had that spat with Lewis and McLaren in 2007, and he's now just so chilled, isn't he?
Mm.
Yet he's lost none of his speed.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think that someone will come on and tell me how wrong I am, but I think is he the most successful of the Formula One drivers to get into a sports car? He's won it twice, isn't he?
Yeah, and he must be.
I mean, there were back in the day, I mean, guys like sort of Phil Hill, who was a world champion, who won it at least twice, maybe three times. But yeah, generally speaking, you know, nice guys tend not to make great Formula One drivers, do they? Mm.
And I wonder how Fernando was changed by doing Le Mans, by doing the Dakar, where you clearly have got a co-driver, a navigator next to you.
Yeah.
You have to work as a team.
Yeah.
I wonder if we see this reformed character in Alonso at Aston Martin today because of his experiences with Toyota. It's possible, isn't it?
It's possible, yeah.
So our mate Jethro Bovingdon was competing this weekend in the N24. He was in a BMW M4 GT4. I think he had a bit of a bruising weekend. He hit the barriers at one point in the race. He was clearly gutted.
Yeah.
But he brilliantly described the N24 as like walking a tightrope for 24 hours.
Yes.
Because you have to be on the very edge, right on the limit, without ever stepping over and falling off. Because if you're not on that edge, you're just not going fast enough.
And it's such a, you know, I've never done the N24. I've done some VLN, so I've raced at the Nürburgring. I have raced in the wet, there in the wet once, but to do all that, just to race at the Nürburgring, when there are maybe 160, 170 other cars in the race, massive, massive differentiation in performance between the front and the back of the grid.
Yeah.
Just to do that for a couple of stints
is
absolutely exhausting. And I've been honest about this before, and I will always say it's a track. It's probably the only track that I have enjoyed having raced on more than I enjoyed racing on it. It's a thing that when you're in your car on the way back to the airport, you look back and go, well, that worked.
Mm.
Proud to survive that. But you're not out there thinking, whoopee, I'm having a great... Well, I'm not. I know some people do. People, you know, people are braver than me. You know, guys like, you know, Dickie, I think Dickie Meaden's done it like 9 times or something.
Yeah, but even he tweeted over the weekend, glad to have done it, glad not to be doing it anymore.
Yeah, and it's that tightrope that you're talking about. And even, you know, in the sort of 6-hour races that I've done, you are so aware of that. And the idea of being out there in the dark and in the rain in a slow car. I mean, GT4 cars probably, Jethro cars probably was probably midfield, wasn't it? Which would have been so much more helpful than some of the stuff that I was in. But even so, out there, middle of the night, pouring down with rain, it's just not somewhere that I want to be.
No, I actually don't fancy it at all. And so the N24 in particular, it's a feat of skill, judgment, but also concentration. Those stints in the night, the speed differential, when you really stop and think about it, it is staggering what the fastest drivers there are capable of. They are superheroes.
Yeah.
So we had dinner last week with Audi Sport.
Yes.
In London, and you and I were sat next to the MD of Audi Sport, Dr. Sebastian Grams. Mm. Lovely guy.
Yeah.
And the next morning, he was flying out to the N24.
Yes.
And so we got chatting with him. We were talking about...
They didn't have a great weekend, did they?
No, they didn't. No, I think their top car came sixth or seventh.
Yeah.
But they won it last year.
They did.
So they know what it takes.
Yeah.
They have the car. They know what it takes. And the bit that we were talking to him, and the bit that really amazed me was the detail that they go into. The lengths that they go into to win this thing. For instance, Audi Sport has a team of meteorologists at the circuit. There's one based in the paddock.
Yeah.
And then there are eight more dotted around the circuit. And they're mobile. They've got scooters, so they can get around a little bit.
Yeah.
It is their job, basically, just to look up.
And presumably you can see them because they're all the ones standing there with their fingers in the air.
Probably. Just staring at the clouds. And it's
and they've got all the radar and all that stuff, haven't they? But there's nothing quite like a pair of eyes on the sky.
And they're not just Audi Sport people who have been told, look out for this kind of... They're meteorologists.
Yeah.
They're experts.
They're professionals. Yeah.
So they can read the sky like you.
Yeah, they're
you
not Audi employees. These are professional meteorologists who have been retained by Audi for the weekend to go and tell them what's going to happen.
And so they can look at clouds coming in and know with a real degree of certainty which cloud is about to dump a load of rain on the circuit.
Yeah.
And of course, you need that kind of insight at the N24 specifically because it's such a long lap.
Yeah.
If you're on the wrong tyres for a lap in changeable weather, a single lap, your race is probably over.
Well, and that's, you know, at best, at worst, you're not coming back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it can get so wet there. Yeah. You and there are these clips, aren't they, where suddenly it's literally as if someone's just emptied a bath on the circuit.
Mm.
And, you know, if you're on slicks... I can remember standing in the pits at Le Mans in 2001, start of 2001, where it just chucked it down. And David Coulthard was standing next to me. He won the race. He won his class in 1993 on a Jaguar XJ220 and then been disqualified over some technicality. But he knew what he was talking about. And all the cars were coming in for wets. And I said to him, how bad would it be out there if you're in slicks in a prototype? And he said, worse than you can possibly imagine. And I said, what, like slower than if you're in a road car? And he just laughed. He said... So much slower than in a road car, you know, you'd think you'd parked.
Jesus.
Yeah.
There was an N24 a few years ago, I think 08, 07, something like that, where everyone was on the grid, you know, it was 10 minutes to the start of the race, and then just the clouds, the heavens opened, and stair rods just... and the circuit flooded, and... I think they had to delay the start of the race, but it just demonstrates how quickly it can turn there. Mm. In those mountains, in the Eiffel, it can just...
And as you say, such a long lap, you get it wrong, even if the car does make it back, somebody else who's on wets could just put, well, an amount of time on you, you're never going to recover in the rest of the race.
Mm. It is staggering. So that's a team of meteorologists. I was amazed by that. Now, if you're going to try and win one of these races, Le Mans N24, any 24-hour race... because they're such long races, because you're doing so many laps, you really have to be going as fast as you can the entire time. And to illustrate that point, imagine losing 1 second a lap to the competition at the N24.
Yeah.
1 second. And how easy would it be to lose 1 second? Maybe in two or three corners, you're a tiny bit more cautious than the other bloke in the other car. Or you're a tiny bit more hesitant getting past traffic.
Yeah.
If you lose a second a lap... at the N24, because you're doing 160-something laps, that's almost 3 minutes at the end of the race. This year, 2.5 minutes covered the top four. So you cannot lose a second a lap in 15 miles.
2.5 minutes covered the top four.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
At Le Mans, a second a lap is 6 minutes.
Yeah, so a second a lap is almost two laps.
Yeah. Yeah.
Over the course of the race.
Yeah.
You're 1 second a lap.
You'll be two down. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And actually, that's when these cars can now be driven flat out, can you imagine if you are a pro driver, and you get these particularly in what they used to call GTM, where you've got, you know, a wealthy owner who will be a really, by any standards, a really, really good driver, in with a couple of pros. But he's just a couple of seconds, which over a long, long lap, I think Le Mans is like an 8.3 mile lap, is, you know, a couple of seconds over that lap is like half a second around.
You'd be delighted, wouldn't you? If that was you, you'd be delighted.
Half a second off the pros, you'd be delighted. Yeah. But if you're the pros, you're sitting there thinking, come on, mate.
Yeah. Get on with it.
You know, you're going to lose a... So that driver in the car, if he does a third of a race, or even does a quarter, he could lose you a lap just by being that tiny, tiny bit slower than you. And that is so often the margin of victory.
It is amazing. And you understand then why the fastest cars in any 24-hour race are ruthless in getting past traffic.
Yeah.
They can't afford to sit behind you in an apex.
And that's why occasionally you get those massive accidents.
Yeah.
Like the one that Anthony Davidson had, one like Alan McNish had.
Yeah.
You know, you approach, you've got to get past.
And the team's watching on the pit wall.
Yeah.
They can see, they know when you've hesitated behind a slower car. And they're probably on the radio going, what happened there?
I just don't want that kind of pressure, do you?
No.
So what do you need? You obviously need a car that's going to get round.
Yeah.
You need teammates who are going to be able to get it round. You need an absolute first. I can remember when, and I keep on talking about Bentley only because I was part of their team for those 3 years they did Le Mans. And when the Yost team came up, because Audi didn't have a works team in 2003, so this was the third year of the Bentley project, and it was the year that they won it. And so basically, Yost got lent to Bentley for that year. And, you know, the team who'd been running up to me, I couldn't have faulted them at all. But then the Yost team came out. And you could just see it was a different level. It was astonishing how good those guys were. And they were so professional and so businesslike. And, you know, it is not a coincidence that the Bentley that won that race spent less time in the pits than any other car in the history of the race.
I was tempted to say one of the things you need to win a 24-hour race is a dose of good luck. And probably there's some truth in that. But you look at the teams that do win, and they win consistently. And it's no fluke, is it, that they keep knocking out wins the way Audi did, the way Porsche has in the past, certain teams at the N24
Let's just look at Porsche for a moment. You know, Porsche never won Le Mans through a technological advantage. They won Le Mans by being very cute with the rules at times. Absolutely fair enough. Nobody ever imagined they'd homologate 25 917s. They did. But the 917 had a smaller engine than the Ferrari. It had two valves per cylinder, not four valves per cylinder, but it still developed more power. If you look at the 956 and the 962, monocoque car with ground effect. Porsche had never done a monocoque car. It had never done a car with ground effect. Had a flat six engine in it, which is the last thing in the world you want if you're trying to do a ground effect car. And yet they still went and did it. I think the problem is, if you're trying to identify the secret to winning Le Mans, the real problem is that there isn't one. You've just, in every single area, you've just got to be better than everybody. You've got to think harder, think smarter. From the moment you sit down to design the car to the last lap of the race. And if you don't do that, someone else will.
So all of this demonstrates exactly how difficult it is to win one of these races.
Yeah.
And if it's a difficult thing to do, clearly it can go very badly wrong.
Yes.
In so many ways.
Yes.
In so many ways.
How many examples do you want?
Let's have them all. Let's start from the beginning, shall we?
Well, should we start in the very first race?
Go on then.
1923. There was a privateer Bentley. It was the only British car in the race. And it was the quickest car in the race. It got fastest lap. But they hadn't prepped it properly. And the track in those days was sort of part gravel, part cinders, part road. And it was just a complete mess. And they got a stone went through the fuel tank because they hadn't protected the fuel tank. And so so the driver, John Duff, got out of the car, ran 4 miles down the track to the pits and went, sorry, guys, we've got a problem. At which stage his co-driver, a bloke called Frank Clement, stole the bicycle, cycled the wrong way around the track. He did say it was utterly terrifying. On a bicycle, on the track, not on a, you know, on a sort of feeder road, or on the track with the traffic, with the race cars coming the other way, got back to the Bentley, repaired the fuel leak from the whole tank. Some say with bacon, others say with chewing gum, but whatever. He repaired it, got the car back to the pit. And by which stage they lost too much time. But then they came back the following year with a properly prepped car and won the race.
Yeah.
So that's how... Yeah. So the following year, actually, another way you could not win Le Mans, although they did manage to do it this time, when they came in for their final fuel stop, they couldn't get one of the wheels off to change the tyres. And there was a bloke called Nobby Clark, who was their chief mechanic, who maintained to his dying day, this was because the French had sabotaged the car.
The French.
And that something like a darning needle had been jammed in there. Anyway, they did get it off, and they got the new one back on, and they went off and won the race. But yes, sabotage is probably one of the rarer reasons to not win Le Mans. But so 1952, Pierre Levesque. So Pierre Levesque, sadly, is the bloke who's most famous for the appalling accident that took place at Le Mans in 1955. But he's also got a claim to fame for being the person who came closest ever to winning Le Mans solo.
Yeah. Gosh.
So he did...
Wow.
Yeah, he did 23 hours on his own. He said his justification for this, because you can imagine how amused his co-driver was, that he could hear something was wrong with the engine, and only he had the mechanical sympathy to see it through. I don't know whether that was true or not, but that is certainly what I understand his excuse to be. And then the irony being that he was so exhausted after 23 hours, he just wrong-slotted or something, and blew it to bits.
Yeah.
And that was the end of that.
Oh, gosh. That would be an extraordinary thing, wouldn't it?
But if he'd done what Louis Rosier had done 2 years earlier. Now, Louis Rosier won a Largo Talbot in 1950. Okay, and he did all but two laps himself. Okay, all but two laps.
Yeah.
But he had the common sense when he was absolutely knackered to get out of the car, put his son in, Jean-Louis, for two laps. While he went off, sorted himself out, had something to eat, probably went to the bathroom.
Yes.
Shook his head, got back in the car, and finished the race and won it.
It's almost a shame that he did that, isn't it, really?
Yeah, but maybe if he hadn't done it and he hadn't just got out of the car, then, you know, and there are, if you look at the people who so nearly did it solo, so, you know, Raymond Sommer in 1932, Luigi Canetti in 1949, you know, the people who succeed in doing huge stints at Le Mans just don't do it completely. There's only been one. Are we going to talk about Eddie Hall's Bentley?
I think we should. Yeah.
Okay, so there's only ever been one documented example, and I've looked into this in such detail, I have no doubt at all that this is true. That in 1950, driving his 16-year-old Bentley, Eddie Hall did the race solo.
Mm.
He came eighth.
So he's the only person
that I'm aware of who's ever successfully completed Le Mans on his own. Yeah, I went out a few weeks ago to America and drove the car, which exists today pretty much in the form that it was when he did the race. But I think he is the absolute prime example of an exception proving the rule.
Mm.
I mean, an extraordinary achievement to do what he did.
We'll be publishing your story on that car this week, I think.
Excellent.
So that is coming up. Well, there you go. So that's... If you're going to win a 24-hour race, you probably need teammates, particularly these days, don't you?
Are we going to briefly sing as we're sort of in that era touch on 1955?
Yeah, because, you know, we're talking about how badly wrong can it go trying to win a 24-hour race. And actually, I mean, we're being quite glib and flippant, aren't we? But the reality is it can go really disastrously.
Well, it did once. And, you know, everybody will know about the Le Mans disaster and the 80-something people who died. And if you look into it, there are so many people who have... The finger has been pointed at. You know, people pointed the finger at Pierre Levesque, who was the chap who went up the back of Lance Macklin's Austin Healey and went into the crowd, pointing out that Fangio got through the gap just before, and Fangio was fine. And said that Levesque was an older man, which he was. His reactions weren't as good, and so on and so forth. Other people have pointed the finger at Lance Macklin, who literally swerved out into the middle of the road. And then the back of his car became a launch pad.
Mm.
And other people have pointed the finger at Mike Hawthorne, who was the reason that Lance Macklin swerved out into the middle of the road, because he overtook him in his Jaguar. And then dived into the pits at the last moment, standing on the brakes. Mm. I've always thought that Mike Hawthorne thought it was his fault. He came in the following lap and said, "I've killed all these people. I'm never going to race a car again." And if you look at it, he certainly started the accident. You know, if you can look, you know, there are so many what ifs. If such a person hadn't done this, such a person hadn't. But the trigger was this was back in the days when the pits, there was no pit lane. Mm. The pits were just the side of the track, on the race course. And so he overtook the Austin Healey, and then he stood on the brakes as hard as he could. And maybe Lance Macklin should have been more aware or whatever. But anyway, he just pulled out. And, you know, if you can point to one thing, which if it hadn't happened, there would have been nothing at all. That was it. But I think somebody once said, I wish I could remember who it was. Somebody once said that the accident was caused by Mike Hawthorn, but the tragedy was caused by the track design.
Well, that there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was the fact that there was the way the track curved at the time, there was, you know, it was fairly unsighted. Having the pits as part of the track was bonkers. Yeah. Having the crowd where it wasn't, and on and on and on. And I think that's probably the fairest summation of it that I've ever heard.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, the sad thing was there will be accidents in racing, but the spectators should never be in danger,
never.
In peril.
No, that is an absolute, to me, that is a red line.
Yeah.
You know, anything that endangers, you know, the public is, you know, I've always been, as people listen to this podcast, I've been always very happy that people who take risks in racing cars know that they're doing that and therefore accept the possible consequences of doing that. But it's a completely different situation with spectators.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gosh.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
So how else can it go wrong then, trying to win a 24-hour race?
Well, so it can go wrong like it went wrong for Nissan in 1990. They turned up with that ridiculous car with 1,100 horsepower. I think I'd be amazed if there's anyone listening to this who hasn't seen Mark Blundell's qualifying lap in that car.
Yeah.
I mean, what an incredible lap that was. And that car was so much faster than anything else out there. And there were lots of them. And you know, I have heard it said, I don't know whether it's true, but I've heard it said that Nissan had their victory literature printed before the race. Well, they're certainly their T-shirts, whatever. And, you know, they all broke.
Mm.
They all just broke. I mean, they turned up with a car that was so much faster than that. I think they must have thought, well, we've got such a performance advantage that we can turn it down a bit if we need to. B, we've got so many cars out there. Well, we're just going to go and cruise it. And they didn't. They broke. It's, you know, it can be... Look at Ford. You know, we all seen Le Mans 66 and, you know, Ford beats Ferrari and, you know, hooray and everything else. You know, there wasn't much mention of the fact that they had two previous attempts at that race and failed first and failed on both occasions. In 64, they came with a prototype. It was a very new car and it didn't have enough power and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the finished thing. But in 1965, they came with 7-litre engines, big blocks, and they absolutely should have won the race. But they didn't because they hadn't thought hard enough about the effect of all that power and extra weight on the rest of the car and the stress of the driveline that they broke and, you know, and a privateer for actually all the works Ferraris broke as well. But, you know, there weren't any 7-litre privateer Fords in the race, but there were, you know, privateer Ferraris and one of those came through to win. So it's just a question of, you need so many things, don't you? You need to run the perfect race, but you also need some luck. And I know we're going to talk about the ultimate example of bad luck in not winning Le Mans, probably... in a minute. But also, you can win Le Mans through luck of a kind. If you think of Mazda in 1991, they were completely unfancied. It was an IMSA car. No Japanese manufacturer, despite Toyota's efforts, had ever won the race before. Now, if you remember, 1991, it was this really, really weird race where it was meant to be the start of the 3.5-litre formula. where and what they did is there were so few cars that were ready, they allowed old Group C cars to race, but they gave them tiny fuel tanks and massive restrictors. And yet they were still much quicker than the in qualifying than the 3.5 litre cars. But they said you can't start in the top 10. So what you had is you had a car qualifying in 11th place, which was like 8 seconds quicker than the car on pole. It was nuts.
Okay.
Yep. So all the 3.5 litre cars got to go first. Mm. And there were only 2 3.5 litre cars of any note, which were a couple of Peugeots. And it was meant to be a race, I guess, between sort of Porsches and Jaguars. And they all just thought, well, they'll get off on brakes, so we won't chase them. And the Peugeots went off and broke. Mm. And then nobody really saw the Mazda coming. But because it was an IMSA car, because it wasn't a Group C car, it didn't have to carry the extra weight. It didn't have to have the smaller fuel tank. And it was never the quickest car out there, but it did the fewest pit stops. And suddenly, it was just kind of like, over time, people were going, well, oh.
Oh, yes.
Oh, blimey. And it was because it was the exception to the rules of all the other prototypes in the race, they suddenly thought, well, maybe. And then Johnny Herbert did an amazing final stint. He was so exhausted he didn't actually appear. I think he was in the medical centre when the other two drivers, who were they? Bertrand Gachot and Volker Wiedler, I think, were on the podium. He didn't even make it there. So, I mean, that's a good example of the rule book playing into your hands and winning a race that way.
So circumstance comes into it sometimes, doesn't it? And you can inherit a victory as well if the leading car or cars breaks.
Or you can be so unbelievably cute with the... Okay, the ultimate example of winning Le Mans by being cute with the rules was the Dower in 1994. This was a Porsche 962, which under the regs at the time should have been rendered completely uncompetitive because it was a Group C car and, you know, as we discussed, it had a small fuel tank, massive restrictor. Not a competitive car. If you wanted a competitive car, because they wanted GT cars to win, you needed to have a car like a Ferrari F40 or a road car, McLaren 911. Well, no, McLarens weren't there. They were the following year, weren't they? But, you know, Porsche 911, Bugatti EB110, I think, were there. And then you could have a big fuel tank and a big restrictor. And so the Porsche 962 just shouldn't have been eligible to win because it wasn't derived from a road car. And then this bloke, Jochen Dauer, decided to make a road car out of the 962. This was all done with the connivance of Porsche. It was effectively a works entry, even though it was never dressed up as such. I mean, Norbert Singer was leading the team. So having made a 962 road car, you could then turn it into a racing car.
So they just had to make one?
Yeah, they just had to make one. So they made...
Yeah.
And there is a 962. There is the Dauer 962. And I think they might have actually done a few afterwards, but it's got leather and air conditioning and that sort of thing. But they turned a racing car into a road car just so they could turn it back into a racing car again.
But the rule makers should see that coming, shouldn't they?
Exactly. You can't blame Porsche for that. No. You know, they were 7 seconds a lap quicker than any other GT car in the race.
Yeah.
And they were slower than the prototypes because the design was quite compromised. But it didn't matter. They had a 120-litre fuel tank and all the other prototypes 80-litre. They had a 50% more fuel capacity.
Mm.
So they just trundled around and cashed and collected.
Well, on the topic of being cute with the rules, and particularly in the GT category... How about just sandbagging for the two or three races before?
Oh, don't. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I don't think we can be definitive about this because we're talking about Ford and the GT and the Ford GT in 2016.
16, yeah.
50 years after they won it in 66. And you know, we have friends at Ford who will deny this, and so I'm not saying at all that this was the case. But it was certainly the impression given that they found a turn of speed at Le Mans in 2016, which their performance in the season to that date had not suggested was likely. Mm. And then, lo and behold, they went and won the GT category.
And that was when Frank Walliser, the boss of the racing department at Porsche, he did that press conference in tears.
Yeah.
He was so gutted.
Yeah.
So, I mean, his views on it were probably quite clear. We don't have to second guess those, do we? But
No. It
is a shame that it's potentially open to manipulation like that. And do you know what? Equally, you and I were at Le Mans as guests of Aston Martin only a couple of years ago.
They got completely stuffed out of sight.
They qualified on pole in the class.
Yeah.
Which you think is a good thing.
Yeah.
Great, we got pole. They were probably excited. They were celebrating. only for the ACO, the regulators, the rulemakers, to go, oh, okay, well, because you're so fast, we're going to change your balance performance, and now you're slower.
Yeah. And in the race, they came nowhere.
They
did also have a problem with tyre consumption, I remember. But yes, but it certainly wasn't helped by that. Mm. And the other thing I find, and I'm not talking about any particular team or race or event here, but if you do decide that in order to gain yourself a favourable balance of performance, which, you know, is this measure which, you know, the organisers have to try and level out the field so you get good racing, and they can add weight, or they can make your restrictor smaller. There are various things they can do to even out the performance across the field. If in order to get a favourable sort of outcome from that, you effectively throw the first two races of the season.
Mm.
What about the spectators who pay good money to go and see their races?
Mm.
And actually, what they don't realise is what they're watching is just a smoke and mirrors job. It's a pantomime.
Yeah.
You're not watching. And I find that very difficult.
Mm.
And I know that the rules are the rules, and you can't blame teams for doing their best under the rules to get the best outcome possible. And the truth is, which you know everybody knows, is there's not a team on the grid of the World Endurance Championship who wouldn't throw every single round of that championship if it meant they could win Le Mans.
Yeah.
Le Mans is more important than all the other rounds put together.
Mm, much more.
And so if that means compromising a few to win Le Mans, can they be blamed for that? Well, it's a sort of, it's an ethical question, is it? I mean, does the spirit of the rules even play a part?
Mm.
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, we've been giggling about the Dower. That didn't come anywhere near to the spirit of the rules, but we think that's quite funny.
Mm.
So maybe if Ford did compromise the performance of those cars, maybe the view is, well, that's what the rules allowed them to do.
Yeah.
And they were just getting the best possible result in the race, in the one race that meant most to them.
Perhaps they were clever.
And if that meant that spectators at Spa and other rounds before that were shortchanged, Ford would say, well, talk to the rulemaker, it's not our fault.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's very, very fair to say that.
Yeah.
Okay, so back to 2016.
Oh, God. Were you there?
I wasn't. No, I was watching the live feed, looking at Twitter.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
Extraordinary.
Kazuki Nakajima.
Yeah.
So this was Toyota's race all day long. They had tried so hard for so long. And it was the TS050, and he was leading the race, and it was absolutely fine, and then it wasn't. It wasn't quite the last lap, because the problem happened before the last lap started, but then it went on to the last lap. So the car came to a halt with, I wrote it down actually, I thought I had, no I didn't. I think it came to a halt with 3 minutes and 25 seconds of the race remaining.
After almost 24 hours.
After 23 hours and 56 minutes and 35 seconds.
Yeah. Ah.
And what was even worse is, although they somehow got it going again and it crawled around the lap, I think the last lap took 11 minutes, and there was a certain minimum time in which you had to complete the final lap, and it wasn't within it. So they weren't even classified.
So it's not like they came second or third.
Didn't even get on the podium. They didn't finish the race.
Yeah.
They were unclassified at the end. And that is the, you know, I can remember I was also there when in 1990, Jesus Pereira in the Brun Porsche, there was a private end in 1960. 1990, the 962 was such an old car. First did a race as a 956 in 1982, so like 8 seasons earlier. And this car, it wasn't leading, but it was second, and it was closing in on the lead Jaguar, which had a problem. And we all going, oh, blimey, blimey, blimey. This old car, amateur car, it could just do it. And then I think it was on the last lap, smoke.
God.
And he came out, he got out of the car. And when they got him back to the pits and his team manager came up to, he literally just collapsed into his arms in tears. And it was just terrible to watch. But nothing like as terrible as that Toyota. It was just... and I think it was... Who was running that? Was it Hugh de Schoenaerts? Whoever was running the Toyota team, the first thing he did was go over to the Audi team and congratulate them on their victory.
Was classy. Porsche. Don't know.
Yeah.
Classy. But do you know what? In a sense, it's... Perhaps surprising it doesn't happen more often, because with minutes to go, the car is going to be at its most frail.
Yes.
And you cannot design them to last for 48 hours, because they'll be too heavy, too bulky, too slow.
Yeah. But they do try. I mean, back, I think they do it less now, but I can remember when Peugeot were trying to win it sort of 10 years back. I mean, they would do a number, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 tests, the shortest of which will be 24 hours. Mm. They do 36-hour tests.
Mm. Yeah.
And they go round and round and round. They go and hire somewhere like Rickard, which is the closest place where the straight long enough to sort of mimic what you get at Le Mans.
Mm.
And they go for a day and a half and try to break the car.
Mm.
But there are so many stories of cars which will do 36 hours on a test without breaking sweat.
But somehow
get to Le Mans. And that's the funny thing about Le Mans. People go, oh, yeah, it's Le Mans, you know, it's a fickle race. Most of me thinks that's all just cobblers. It's a race, it's a circuit, you know, there's no such thing as luck or chance or anything else. But sometimes the best laid plans just fall up. I mean, in 1987, I think there were 10 rounds in the World Endurance Championship that year, maybe 11. The Jaguar XJR8 was so far and away the quickest car in that season. It won every single round.
Yeah.
Apart from one.
Le Mans.
Mm. So I don't know. It's a funny old race, and I'm so sad I'm not going to be there this year. But I'm taking a thing called a holiday, which is
interesting.
Strange thing for me to be doing, but and it's the only time that I can be away, so I'm not going to be there. But who do you think is going to win?
Well, this is the year that we've all been looking forward to, isn't it?
Yes.
Because we've got a handful of manufacturers in the hypercar category now.
Yeah, Ferrari back after 50 years.
Ferrari, Porsche. There's a whole load of them, isn't there? Peugeot, notably Toyota.
Yeah, Toyota.
And it does look as though, but Toyota have been running their hypercar for a couple of years now.
Yeah, and as we record this, they have won every round of the championship this year.
So they've got to be going in as favourites.
Who will the ACO want to win, though?
What are you suggesting?
Well, the fairy tale ending, and I think anybody would think this, is that on their 100th anniversary race, in the 50th anniversary since Ferrari were last there, that a Ferrari would win the race.
Mm.
And... what can I say? I just hope it's a good fair fight.
Let's just hope for a great race.
Yeah.
No question marks over any subterfuge or underhand tactics. Let's just hope for a brilliant, brilliant race. There we go. That's what it takes to win a 24-hour race, and that's how that's how badly wrong it could go in the pursuit of doing so. Okay, so we're not doing a listener question this week. Instead, we're doing a What Goes Up, and I speak to Darren from JBR Capital. A couple of weeks ago, in episode 159, we looked at how the mainstream car manufacturing sector is recovering after COVID, after the chip shortage, the war in Ukraine, several other stressors. Now, with your help, Darren, we're looking at what's going on at the prestige end of the market. And headlines are, well, for three storied marks in particular, it's good news, isn't it?
It's very good news if your name is Lamborghini, Porsche or Ferrari.
Indeed.
They are churning these cars out the factories and reporting record profits. I mean, just set the scene a little bit. I mean, Lamborghini's turnover is up 22.8%, profits up 35%. They've got full, it's almost full order books. The 2024, they're not even mentioning 2023, so I think we'll just assume that they're full.
Yeah.
Porsche the same, increasing 25% in profits. And deliveries to customers of new cars up to 80,767 deliveries. That's up a whopping 18% from the same period last year.
Wow.
Ferrari, very similarly, 27% increase in profits. So manufacturers are having it off.
Blimey, yeah, those three certainly are. And actually, in the case of Porsche and Ferrari, they've both said they will be increasing prices this year by a handful of percentage points. And it's what does it speak to? I mean, it paints a clear picture, doesn't it? Certainly for those three.
It paints a little bit of a murky picture, but go on, tell me why you think it paints a clear picture.
For those three, it's a clear picture, even though there continue to be factors weighing on car manufacturing, semiconductor shortage, all the others, COVID, war in Ukraine, these things are sort of still rumbling on, high interest rates as well. Those three marks in particular having a jolly old time.
If you're a manufacturer, you're having a jolly old time, and they are obviously, even in the premium sector, the cream of the crop, really.
Absolutely.
Rolls Royce is going to be in there as well, but some pretty the top brands, as you would expect. And yes, prices are going up by about 4 to 8% to cover higher production costs, you know, due to inflation, the big inflation story that everyone talks about. But for me, I say it's a little bit murky in reality, because yes, manufacturers are having a great time, but this tells the story in new cars only. And it doesn't really tell you what is going on in the whole of market, which of course is dominated by the used car sector, which, you know, there are, you know, multiple times of used cars sold compared to the new cars, and the lucky individuals that get hold of those wonderful limited edition Ferraris and Lamborghinis, etc. So that's where they're making all their money. So if you just looked at the new car sales market, that would potentially imply that the wealthy customer bases aren't really too bothered about inflation and the higher cost of borrowing, etc. And the story trundles on. However, I say, when you go and look in the used car market, in the volume market, in the lower cost brands, that continues to be very strong throughout 2023, with demand continuing to outstrip supply, with demand up about 8% and supply down about 9%. So all going very well. But when you start looking in the premium market, and Auto Trade have done a bit of a study on this, the demand has increased in the used car market by about 10%, but the supply is now outstripping demand, which is very exacerbated in the used market. And for cars that cost over £150,000, Auto Trader had 3,194 cars listed in April, compared to 2,252 in April last year. So there's 42% more premium cars being advertised on Auto Trader than there were last year, and cars are taking longer to sell. It's now taking dealers on average 80 days to sell a premium car, which is 24 days more than last year. So is it all rosy? Is it all going well? It certainly is in the new car market, but I would dare hazard a guess that in the used car market, the bolts on the wheels are coming loose just a little bit.
Wow.
I'm not saying it's all going downhill fast, but certainly you need to look at the whole of market picture to truly understand what's going on. So I did take the opportunity to speak to quite a few of the independent dealers in the market, which I think would be fair to say are a good bellwether test of what's going on. And indeed, most of the ones I talk to are reporting that it is hard to sell cars. It's taking long to sell cars. They've slowed down buying stock, just being a little bit more cautious, slightly worried values may fall further than they expect. And, you know, just a bit of a cautionary tale going on there. I don't personally think that prices will plummet or anything in the luxury market, but certainly, as cars take longer to sell, dealers start slowing down buying stock, it's more difficult for individuals to sell their cars. And that's why you see listings going up on Auto Trader. So
interesting.
I think that's where we're at. But I got asked the other day, well, do you think this is because of inflation and the higher cost of borrowing? Obviously, everyone knows the interest rate story and the rapid increase in rates over the last 12 months. Up until now, we've not seen that having any impact on wealthy customers or put them off from buying. And actually, I don't think it is. I just think we're seeing a small slowdown. And I think it's because we're going through a cycle of reaching saturation. And it tends to happen every 5 years or so. You know, customers get into that habit of changing the car every 18 months, changing the next model, the next one up. And it gets to a point where sometimes people just say, you know, I've just had enough of this for the minute, and I'm going to just take a little breather. And I personally think that it's more about that than inflation or interest rates.
Do you know, that's why we like talking to you guys about this stuff, because it, you have insights that we don't have, particularly around the used car market. It is your job to know precisely what's going on, isn't it?
Well, we like to think so, but we've seen it in our own numbers. And, you know, we've been having record month after record month, and certainly in March, we paid out around £31 million loans. It was an all-time record for us in our eight-year history. And then April was hard to get going. I mean, we still paid out £25 million, so don't feel too sorry for us. But we were hoping to do a little bit more than that. And again, ring around all my friends and all the other finance companies saying, what are you seeing? You know, what's going on? Industry events as well. And it was all the same thing, struggling to see the month actually get going. I mean, you just see a little bit of malaise in the market, and I think that's a good word, malaise.
Interesting. So now, what's your instinct on this? Do you think it, for people who are in the market, who are looking to buy right now, does it mean that they might be getting good deals?
I think there's definitely better deals to be had out there. There's certainly more choice of cars than there were before, so perhaps you can be more picky on getting a better specification on your car, the right colour that you wanted, and you've got a bit more time to shop around. I mean, for the last few years, it has been quite difficult for customers because they would see cars, make their minds up on them, and then finally, once they've made their mind up, actually the car's been sold, and then you have to start all over again. So it is taking a bit longer for cars to sell. There's more choice. So definitely a bit of a buyer's market in the used car sector. But again, if you want one of those lovely new Lamborghinis, Porsches or Ferraris, you're going to be waiting some time for them. And yeah, but you know, the one that is got everyone talking in the last few months is electric cars in the EV market. And the both the volume and the premium market have suffered significantly in terms of, well, good news for consumers who want to buy an electric car, but significantly impacted, you know, with prices falling around 18% year on year in April. And supply is continuing to outpace demand by quite a bit. And this is the same in the premium market as the volume market. And, you know, everyone says, well, is that market finished? Are people going to adopt EV? What's actually going to happen? But I don't think so. I think it's just a catch up and a realignment in the market. I mean, when you look at the demand, demand is still increasing by about 15 to 20% year on year. When you look at April, I just think the market's got a little bit flooded with cars. Certainly people like Tesla are making moves to reduce the cost to consumer and reducing their prices, and everyone else has had to follow. And there's a lot of cars out there. So I think EV is still popular. And, you know, it's just going to happen, isn't it?
It is.
Unfortunately, I never said that.
But it's never going to be a straight line, is it? It's going to come in waves and just kick up and down a little bit. And that's just the way it is. Well, we need to do this again in a couple of months. And you'll fill us in again on what the latest is. Because it's fascinating to get a proper, detailed, in-depth insight into what is going on, particularly in the used car market, because it affects all our listeners. You know, it's important stuff.
Yeah, well, as I said at the start, you can look at one small sector and look at the profits of these luxury manufacturers. And yes, manufacturers are having a great time, but you need to look at the whole of market and just see what's going on. So, you know, I do think it will pick up. I think it's just got to get that supply and demand element right, and it will find its natural place.
Brilliant. Interesting stuff, Darren, and thanks for coming on. We'll do it again. What Goes Up is sponsored this week by car finance specialist JBR Capital. We've been working with JBR Capital for a while now, and it's been a brilliant partnership for us. High-end car finance is all the company does, meaning it understands the car market and car buyers better than most. So before you buy your next sports car, supercar, classic car, luxury car, even a brand new car, go and see what JBR Capital can do for you on the finance side. Visit jbrcapital.com or click the link in description. And this bit is important. Tell them the Intercooler sent you. JBR Capital is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.